Sange Chittang Sukhi Jhunam Jangju Bhardu Dhammi Kya Suchi Dagi Jim Sagi Bhisonam Ghe Dola Pinchu Sange Dhu Harshan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha's Dharma and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha, to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened, to the Buddha's Dharma and the assembly of saints, from the virtuous merits that I collect, by the practice of giving and the other perfections, and attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness in the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering in the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers, sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering as a Buddha rite, may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure light. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariwara Ratna Mandava Pudra Mega Samundra Saparana Samaye. Welcome to Sakyapandita. Last time we read some of Sakyapandita's biography, and I'd like to read a little more this evening because he's such an important figure, both historically, politically, spiritually. He was a giant figure. I'm reading from the brand new translation of Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche's Concise History of the Glorious Sakya School, translated by David Jackson. So the language that you will hear will be Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche's poetic language. There's a couple of phrases that are kind of unusual. From the age of 8 until his passing away at the age of 69, Sakyapandita taught the Dharma daily. He gave rise to many thousands of disciples. Sakyapandita composed numerous correct treatises that benefited the 10 branches of knowledge, most prominent among which were the clear differentiation of the three codes and the treasury of reasoning on valid cognition, which he wrote without depending on anybody else. He also wrote many explanatory texts that filled gaps in the tenjer, and he translated numerous Sanskrit texts. He is noted as being the pioneering scholar who initiated the study of the latter three of the five outer subjects, or literary arts. And there's a footnote, the five outer subjects are rhetoric, astrology, dramatics, grammar, and poetics. He is quoted as saying about these traditions, "Before me, this tradition did not exist." Sakyapandita's reputation paralleled that of the matchless Indian masters such as Dharmakirti, emitting a laugh of peerless scholarly confidence. Moreover, the banner of his great qualities unfurled in all directions for all to see. Consequently, every human ruler in this world wished to gaze upon the moon of his face, and many envoys bearing invitations came to him. Among them, he accepted one from Kudan Khan, the Mongol ruler. As a result of previous aspirations and for the sake of benefiting his Tibetan students. That ruler was unmatched in terms of splendor and conducted himself in the tradition of Genghis Khan. He commanded that since a Lama who could teach the path to liberation and omniscience was important, they should invite Sakyapandita, since nobody in Tibet was more learned. Thus, as his own guru, Jasantrapa Gyaltsen, had prophesied, Sakyapandita became highly honored in Western China after being invited there. Through his many inconceivable deeds of body, speech, and mind, he spread the Buddhist teaching throughout innumerable borderlands. And since he freed Khotan Khan from his illness, he inspired profound faith in that ruler. Nevertheless, one day when Sakyapandita was teaching a sutra and had reached the passage about the tortoise having no hair, the ruler and his ministers decided to test Sakyapandita. To that end, the ruler instructed a Chinese magician to create a magically emanated temple at the side of a lake and then invited Sakyapandita to meet him there. In a state of meditative concentration, Sakyapandita stabilized the magically projected temple by scattering flowers over it. And I'll just say as a parenthesis that Lama Jampa told me that he scattered the flowers with the mantra that we recite here at the end of every puja, which was Supratishtha Vajraye Soha, three times throwing flowers, which is a kind of supplication for the wisdom powers to remain. So Lama just told me that just now. That's what he said when he spread the flowers. At that point, the magician became unable to destroy the illusion. The ruler and his retinue were then filled with even greater, deeper faith. It is called the Magical Temple of the North, and that temple can still be seen to this day in the Western Chinese borderland in Lingchu County, Lingchu Prefecture. Later, when Sakyapandita's Tibetan students beseeched him to return to Tibet, he wrote the treatise entitled Clarifying the Sage's Intent. And he sent it down to them in a letter. And in that way, Sakyapandita made the teachings of the Buddha flourish in time and space. And finally, while residing in the magically emanated temple, in the Iron Pig year, 1251, at the age of 69, he passed away into the spiritual realm of Vidyadhara, and after traversing there most of the five paths and bodhisattva levels, he would, in the pure land of Amirati, become the Buddha named Vimalashiri. Thus was it foretold by tutelary deities and the gurus. This was later confirmed by his nephew Chögyapakpa, who said, in answer to a scholar's question, "Yes, a few years have passed since my guru, the Lord of Dharma, became a Buddha." So that's some more from the biography of Sakyapandita. He also did many other things. One of the things he did was, when he went to Mongolia, they had no written script, and so he invented the Mongolian script, which they use, I think, still today. That's our great master, Sakyapandita. Clarifying the Sage's Intent is one of his masterpieces, and as we said before, it's based on a text by Maitreya, the coming Buddha. Sage's Intent puts quite a bit of emphasis on the six perfections as the actual practice. Well, how do you do it? How do you become enlightened? It's a nice idea, but what's the mechanics of it? There's a large amount of it devoted to the six perfections. And this will be the third evening that we've talked about generosity, which is the first perfection. But we're almost finished with generosity. But the last section is called the benefits of generosity. We've talked about the definition of it, the nature of it, and so on. And now we're at the benefits. Sakyapandita says that there's two types of benefits. There's temporary benefits and there's ultimate benefits. Of the temporary benefits, there's two types. There's the benefit for this life, and there's the benefits for future lives. Whereas the ultimate benefit is Buddhahood. To elaborate on those points, His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin said, the next topic is the benefits of generosity, of which there are two types, temporary and ultimate. Temporary benefits are also of two types, benefits in this life and benefits in later lives. The temporary benefits in this life are that by giving, we can make others happy. As a result of this, we can also gain more wealth, fame, and happiness in this life, even though these are not our aims. These results occur naturally without us putting deliberate effort into gaining them. Indeed, it would be wrong to make such temporary benefits the aim of our efforts. But if they are spontaneously achieved as a result of our generosity, then there is no fault. The temporary benefits we can receive in our future lives are, as it reads in Sakyapandita's text, quote, the type of result in which what you experience agrees with the causing deed, unquote. Which means attaining whatever we desire. Another benefit is that, quote, your future actions agree with the causing deed, unquote, which means that, due to the strong habitual tendency accumulated in this life, having become brave enough to give others whatever they desire, we will have the wish to perform acts of generosity in future lives as well, which will be possible with the wealth that we gained as a result of past generosity. And also in future lives, we will not be born in a poor place or one afflicted by famine and the like. The ultimate benefit or result of practicing generosity is the attainment of Buddhahood. It's said that to accomplish Buddhahood, we need to practice the six perfections. And the perfection of generosity as one of the six perfections is, therefore, one of the causes needed to accomplish Buddhahood. When we attain Buddhahood, the special qualities that will be produced by the practice of generosity are that, as a Buddha, we can gather an ocean-like assembly of followers, which includes both ordinary and noble followers. These are just some of the many results of generosity obtained when we attain Buddhahood. So just to elaborate on that last part, the goal of Buddhahood is not to have a lot of disciples, but that happens naturally, and it happens for the benefit of the disciples. It doesn't happen for the benefit of the Buddhas. They don't need anything. So it's important to be clear about that. And when it says the followers will include both ordinary and noble followers, ordinary followers are people like us, regular folks on the path. The noble followers are these bodhisattvas that we keep referring to who have attained what are called the grounds or the bhumis. There are 10 of those, and they are very, very high attainments. And we're I keep saying we're going to get into that later, and we will get into that later. But just to give you an idea, the first bhumi alone, which is the lowest of the ten, you have many, many spiritual powers, including the power of emanating 100 different bodies simultaneously. So those types of bodhisattvas, they're not quite enlightened yet. They're getting there, though. They will be among your disciples, too, as well as regular disciples. Ape Rinpoche says about this topic, as to the benefits of generosity, one will gain prosperity, fame, and happiness during this lifetime, and in future lifetimes, one will attain whatever one desires. One will be able to give to others whatever they desire, and one will not be reborn in an evil land or during times of famine and the like. The ultimate beneficial result of the perfection of generosity is that, at the time of attaining Buddhahood, one will be able to gather followers of both mundane and supermundane beings in quantities as vast as the ocean. And furthermore, one will receive an abundance of offerings resulting from virtuous actions and gain mastery over many meditative absorptions, such as the meditative absorption of sky treasury, which enables us to call forth a rain of riches from the sky. These are the particular benefits one will gain from the practice of generosity. So this sky treasury is one of the many powers that Buddhas have, which is basically the ability to manifest on the material level anything that's needed spontaneously and instantaneously. And later on, we'll go into the powers of the Buddha and the qualities of the Buddha, of which there are many, but that's one of them. It's called the sky treasury. It is a, quote, fabulous, magical, inexhaustible source of wealth. So that, my friends, concludes the chapter on generosity. Are there any questions about that before we go on to a new chapter? Okay, so that finishes chapter 4, and chapter 5, I have one other note I would like to add about generosity, because I think it's relevant. There's reference to it in the text, but it's not elaborated. There's a reference to the 7 secondary bodhisattva vows applying to the perfection of generosity. These are a list of downfalls. If you do these, you create damage to your bodhisattva vow. And we're going to talk about the importance of vows. But for now, we'll just go through what they are in applying to generosity, the perfection of generosity. The first downfall is not making offerings to the 3 jewels through the 3 gateways of your body, speech, and mind. For example, when we come here, we light candles to make a light offering, or we bring flowers to make a flower offering, or food to make a food offering, and so on. There's sort of approved offerings. So we need to be making those continuously if we take the bodhisattva vow. That's the first one. The second one is following the mind that strives for any of the 5 objects of desire, that is sensory pleasure, a good reputation, accumulating more things, greed and attachment to gain and respect, and not being content with what one has. All of those are the second one, following those in a kind of attached sort of way. Number 3, not showing respect to elders. Number 4, giving no answer to a sincerely asked question which one is capable of answering. Number 5, not accepting invitations when invited as a guest. Number 6, not accepting material gifts.
I'm breaking that one all the time, Michael. Can you repeat the last one?
Not accepting invitations? Okay, this is my opinion, because the text didn't elaborate on it. So I'm just going to tell you what I'm thinking about it. if someone offers in a kind of generous way, and I'll just say that the next one is not accepting material gifts. So they kind of go together in that sense. This, again, this is my opinion. For a meritorious action to be completed, in the case of generosity, it has to be accepted. So if I say, would you like a cookie? And you say, no, no, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. Yeah. I don't get any merit because you didn't accept it.
Yeah.
We have referred to appropriate and inappropriate gifts, like you don't give a machine gun to a monastic, for example, to make an extreme example.
Because they would have to take it.
They have to take it.
Oh my God, sorry.
You don't offer a nun a six-pack. They have to take it. Of course, they will dispose of it. But the point being, I think, yeah, is that we need to get into the idea of generously giving, but also generously receiving, even if maybe we don't want it.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Like, there's too much sugar in that cookie, I don't want it. I'll take it anyway, and I'll figure out later what to do with it.
And this is in the context of this cultivating the sage's intent.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what you would do by accepting that offer.
Yeah, I'm failing in that department. I don't do it.
I don't think it means you have to accept every invitation you get. I don't think it means that. But again, I'm just saying what I think. Yeah. Because there are some things I don't accept. I mean, invitations. Like,
yeah,
do you want to go to the, what's it called? The concert that's been going for 10 days every
night?
I wouldn't go to that. For one thing, it would break my ears. You know?
Yeah.
So I don't think it means you have to accept everything. But I think what it means is you have to be generous in your attitude. Because remember, perfections are mental activities. It's not the cookie or the physical gift. It's the mental state of mind that we're talking about here. We have to remember that, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. We're not talking about ordinary generosity. We're talking about perfection. Does anybody have a better answer to Angelo than that?
No, it's good enough. Yeah.
Yeah, I did a double take when I read that one the first time, too. Okay. So that's 5 and 6. And then the 7th one is not giving the Dharma to those who seek Dharma. Now, there is a caveat with that one, which is we don't teach emptiness to unripe recipients because it's too easy for them to flip it into nihilism. And they're not ready yet. You know, matches have a purpose, but not as a toy for a little baby. So we have to be appropriate when it comes to talking about emptiness in front of somebody, you know, a new person mainly. If they're not ready, we'll talk about other things. So that needs to be understood in this last one. You teach Dharma to those who seek Dharma in the appropriate circumstances. And also, we need to remember that generosity is not just giving physical objects, these four kinds of which are giving fearlessness. If you can save somebody who's drowning or an animal that's going to be killed for dinner or something like that, you're taking away their fear. Giving loving kindness is one of the categories of generosity. Giving Dharma, teaching Dharma or talking about Dharma is another one. And then the 4th one is material objects. So we need to keep that in mind too, that there are these other categories that are assumed when we're talking about giving objects. It doesn't have to be an object. So those are the secondary bodhisattva vows for the perfection of generosity. Okay, so now we're finished chapter 4. Chapter 5 is, the next perfection is the perfection of morality, sometimes referred to as moral discipline. Sakya Pandita said that we need to understand the definition, we need to understand the nature of it, and we need to understand the benefits of it. In regard to the definition, Sakya Pandita says that the definition of morality is, quote, abstaining from moral misdeeds in order to benefit others. If that moral discipline is endowed with a correct preparation, the actual action, and the conclusion, that is, the dedication, it becomes the perfection of moral discipline. Apay Rinpoche defines morality as the mental state which longs to discard non-virtuous deeds. So there again, it's a mental state. It's, you know, what state your mind is in, rather than the actual action itself. His Holiness 42nd Psychotreason defines it as morality as, quote, abstaining from moral misdeeds in order to benefit others. And he elaborates on that point by saying, the term misdeeds refers to negative actions such as killing and so forth. But actually, there is a difference between just abstaining from killing and the wish to abandon the act of killing. And here, I think the definition is not merely abstaining from moral misdeeds, but rather abandoning moral misdeeds in order to benefit others. Just abstaining from or avoiding misdeeds is not moral discipline. To qualify as moral discipline, we must have the wish to abandon these negative actions, which means that it is also based on mental action, not just the physical act of abstaining from these deeds. Just as with the perfection of generosity, which mainly refers to the intention to give to others, the practice of the perfection of moral discipline is mainly accomplished with the mind, not the body. Furthermore, the mere intention and act of abandoning misdeeds does not constitute pure moral discipline. Here as well, we can distinguish two kinds of discipline. If we abandon misdeeds based on the right intention, it becomes pure moral discipline. If, on the other hand, we abandon them out of attachment to this life or to samsara, our discipline is not considered pure. This means that true moral discipline is the wish to abandon misdeeds based on the thought of renunciation. That is to say, the wish to gain liberation from the whole of samsara, that is the right motivation. We cannot have pure moral discipline without the thought of renunciation, no matter how diligent we are in keeping the precepts. And furthermore, as it's said in the text, the practice of the perfection of moral discipline has three parts: the correct preparation, the actual action, and the conclusion. And when moral discipline is endowed with these three parts, it becomes the complete perfection of pure moral discipline. As with the perfection of generosity, the preparation means developing the enlightenment thought, based on which we then observe moral discipline. This is moral discipline according to the Mahayana Great Vehicle tradition. Abbe Rinpoche says, the second of the six perfections is the perfection of morality. Generally speaking, morality refers to the mental state which longs to discard non-virtuous deeds. It's the foundation for practicing patience, meditation, and the other perfections. And since all the practices require discipline, the practice of moral discipline is necessary training for everything which follows. It's like preparing the soil to grow crops. When we later on engage in virtuous actions, they will increase and multiply, and the flow of positive results will be incessant. On the other hand, without the support of moral discipline, we will not succeed in developing any other spiritual quality. The way to transform mundane morality into the perfection of morality is to engage in it with the motivation to liberate all sentient beings, conjoined with the Mahayana view of ultimate reality. When both the Enlightenment thought and the Mahayana view of ultimate reality are conjoined with morality, it becomes the perfection of morality. Although ordinary worldly beings engage in morality, it's not possible for them to practice the perfection of morality because they do not generate the Enlightenment thought and they lack the Mahayana great vehicle view of ultimate reality.
So, like, if you were to say, can you put that into, like, your own personal experience? So let's say you were going to do debating whether you should, actually, like, something moral that you're going to do, but before you do that, like, something in your life comes up, and you're like, this is the moral thing to do, but I'm going to do it because it frees people from suffering, and ultimately, there is no them or I, we're all, they're, like, everything. So is that what you, or like, how do you put those together, like, in your own mind, so that it's cohesive?
Well, I'll give you examples which are classic examples given, because this is a normal question, like, well, how do you do that? So, one of the examples which is given is that there are two people walking through the woods, and one person is a Mahayana great vehicle practitioner, and the other person isn't. So they're walking along in the woods, and then they find a nice spot, and they sit down, and there's like a fork in the road where they're sitting, and they're enjoying the quiet of the forest, and they're sitting there. And all of a sudden, a deer comes hopping along beside by them and takes the road to the left. And so they go, isn't that nice? There's a deer, you know. And then a few minutes later, a hunter comes along, and he says, hey, you guys see any deer around here? Now, if you just practice regular morality, you don't tell lies, you would say, yeah, the deer went to the left. Because that's the truth, the deer went to the left. But a Mahayana practitioner, knowing that the hunter was going to kill the deer, mm-hmm. an act of generosity would be to save the life of the deer. In that case, the Mahayana great vehicle practitioner would tell a white lie and say, oh, the deer went down that way to the right, and mislead the hunter so that the hunter wouldn't kill the deer, thereby saving the deer's life, but also there's some question about the morality of shooting animals, right? So that would all be eliminated by telling a white lie and saying, no, the deer's over there. So technically speaking, he told a lie, and you're not supposed to do that. I mean, lie, steal, kill, we all know that, right? Mm-hmm. But from a higher point of view, there's a greater good to benefit, so you break the rules.
But it also talked about, like, you thinking about internally, like, there was two things. One, knowing that there isn't, like, a true self, was one of them, and then the second thing was liberation. Like, so when you're saying these, like, when you tell the person or the hunter, it's like knowing that there really isn't a hunter or a deer, or like even a you there, and also knowing that ultimately you just want to liberate. Like, is that what you want to keep thinking about all the time? Is that what that thing is saying, or is that just like an added, like, you should be feeling this all the
time? What is this? Yeah, so we have to sort out relative truth and absolute truth. On the relative level, there is a deer, there is a hunter, there are the two guys in the woods. On the ultimate level, there's none of that. So until you're enlightened, you're not really operating at the ultimate level. So you can't really use that as an excuse. You have to operate on the relative level. That's where we generate merit, that's where we do our practice, and that's where we go along the path towards Buddhahood. So we have to be clear with ourselves and with our language that we don't mix up those two types of truth. It's called the two truths, right? Relative and absolute, or ultimate. So we need to specify, now I'm talking about relative truth, or now I'm talking about absolute truth. In this case, the story of the deer, that's relative truth. However, we know that there is ultimate truth, and we know, depending on our spiritual development, we know at least somewhat that there is no self, there is no independent existence, there is emptiness and all these ultimate truth descriptors, which are, by the way, only descriptors because there aren't any words on the ultimate level. But we have to say something about it because we're not there yet. So it points us in that direction and we aspire towards it. And eventually we'll get there. But for now, we're operating in the world of relative truth where there are deer and hunters and guys in the woods.
Sorry, the only reason why I'm pointing this out is because it says, like, perfect. It's a perfect, what was that word you used? It was, like, perfect morality versus morality.
Yeah.
And so in perfect morality, it seems like you have to hold those things in mind in order for it to be perfect.
You do. Knowing that we operate on the relative level.
Okay. That's all I wanted.
And we know the ultimate level at whatever point we're at in our spiritual development. And that's a long road. And we don't actually get to what they call the attainment of emptiness until we get to this famous first bhumi, the first bodhisattva level. So it's a high attainment to get there. But we do know about it, and we're learning about it, and we're practicing it. If you come to the Manjushri practice on Sunday, that's a practice for wisdom to attain that. Did that answer you?
More or less.
More or less, okay. We'll settle for more or less. There are other stories to illustrate this question, but that's a kind of simple one that's easy to understand. Some of them are a little more, a bit of a stretch. Maybe we'll go into that some other time. So just to repeat, there is one more quote, which is essentially saying the same thing by His Holiness the 42nd Sakya Treason, who says, quote, "In terms of the actual action, our practice of moral discipline should be sealed by the transcendental wisdom that realizes selflessness, and then in conclusion we should seal it with dedication. And if the moral discipline is complete with these three parts, it becomes the perfection of pure moral discipline." So what this does is it deepens our understanding of how do you actually practice these perfections. It isn't just like that. There are these parts that have to be there before it really qualifies as a perfection. That concludes the definitions, a couple of three definitions of what is morality. As far as the nature of moral discipline, there are three sections. Identifying the antithesis to discipline, discerning the individual antidotes, and three, correctly accomplishing the moral discipline. So we're going to go into those three categories now and explain those. So in terms of the first one, identifying the antithesis, there's a few parts. The first one is not keeping the moral vows that you have promised. The second one is following the wrong type of morality. For example, there are some religions which promote human sacrifice or animal sacrifice or things that we would consider not really moral. So it's to avoid following that type of morality. The third one is practicing the morality of the foundation path, which cannot become a cause for full enlightenment because the goal of that path is not enlightenment, it's liberation. So they don't have, for example, the bodhisattva vow and that whole aspect of it. And this is a Mahayana text, so we're advised here not to go in that direction, but to stay in this direction. To elaborate on that, Apai Rinpoche says, "The unfavorable consequence of impairing our morality accruing in this lifetime is that we will be criticized by people around us, and we will also feel ashamed even to appear before our teacher. to sit with other members of the spiritual community or to receive offerings. This is because when we know that our morality is not pure, it instills a kind of cowardice or timidity within us. We feel very small when we receive offerings, and not only will other people criticize and blame us, but non-humans will also make obstacles for us. And the gods who protected us in the past will no longer protect us, and the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas will be displeased. In the Sakyapandita text, he says, in general, it's impossible for a person of corrupt moral discipline to attain a happy existence in the future. The Buddha taught that by breaking even a subordinate part of the moral discipline, you will be reborn in the realm of the Nagas. And even if you escape from the miserable lower realms and are born in a higher existence, everything undesirable, such as a short lifespan, will befall you as a human. Because of killing others, your life will be short. Because you stole, you will lack wealth. Because of sexual misconduct, you will have many enemies. And because of lying, you will be slandered. Because of covetous thoughts, your hopes will be crushed. And because of harmful thoughts, suffering will arise. The primary result of all of this for humans is to go to the miserable lower realms of existence. At this point, the teacher should tell the story of Elapatra. Do you want to hear the story of Elapatra?
Yes. How do you order it? Covenant thought.
Wanting something that belongs to somebody else.
The following story of the Naga king Elapatra illustrates this. It's said that a long time ago, during the time of Buddha Kashyapa, who was the Buddha before Shakyamuni Buddha, the third Buddha of our age, there was a monk who lived in seclusion in the forest of Ela trees. And one day a leaf fell from the tree onto his head, and he thought to himself, there is no life force in this tree. It has no feelings. Why did the Buddha establish a rule that prohibits monastics from cutting down trees? So, disregarding the Buddha's teaching, he decided to cut down the tree. As a result of this deed, he was born as a Naga during the time of Buddha Shakyamuni. He was called Elapatra because of a large tree growing out of his head, and it was always pressing down on him, which was the result of him disregarding the Buddha's rule for monastics of not cutting trees. And this story illustrates the serious consequences of not keeping the moral discipline purely according to the Buddha's teachings. So as it says, one of the rules for monastics is they're not to cut trees or grass. In other words, respect the environment. This tree, it doesn't go into detail here, but this tree that was growing out of Elapatra's head was really big, and every time the wind blew, the tree swayed, and the roots were in his head, and it caused him tremendous headaches. He really, really suffered from that. This is one of the stories to illustrate the importance of keeping even small rules, even small vows. Obviously, monastics have lots of vows, and that's one of them. And even though, as in this case, he thought, well, what's the difference? You know, it's just, you know, it's just a tree. You shouldn't think that way. You should respect the morality of the vow that you took. Obviously, monastics take more vows than lay people do, but still there are lay vows. So that's the story of Elapatra.
Are we going to go through the lay vows or the lay rule?
We're going to talk about vows, not right in this moment, and the importance of taking at least some. So come back. Stay tuned. So now we're going to talk about discerning the individual antidotes. So we have the cause and the result. So Sakyapandita says, discerning the individual antidotes involves two steps. The first of which is ascertaining the antidote to the cause of deficient moral discipline. The cause of breaking moral discipline is predominantly the afflictions. We must discuss two types of antidotes against them, partial suppression and eradication. Partial suppression is the first antidote to the afflictions. On this, the question of Subahu Tantra states, those in whom desire predominates should remove it by viewing the object of desire as unclean. For anger, there should be the cooling water of love. For bewilderment, there's the understanding of the path of interdependence. And for pride, there is the differentiation of the elements. That means the skandhas, the five elements that make up our appearance, form, feeling, perception, concept, and consciousness. So that's the suppression. The eradication comes from the antidote that completely eradicates the afflictions, which is taught through the exposition of valid cognition, which states, the view of emptiness will free you. The remaining meditations are for that purpose. That's a quote from Dharmakirti. And Nagarjuna said, ignorance ceases through knowledge of just this, the ultimate reality, which comes through meditation. Through the cessation of this and that link, the remaining links will not arise. How you realize emptiness. It cannot be realized through reading a book or hearing somebody talk about it. It's only through meditation. But in order to get to that level of meditation, we need a lot of merit. So the first five perfections accumulate the merit, which is then necessary for the realization of the sixth perfection, which is called wisdom, which means realization of emptiness, realization of interdependence, and there's different ways of describing it, realizing that there is no description of it because it's the ultimate level and there are no words. That's what those two quotations were referring to, that the way that we eradicate, the way that we finally uproot our afflictions is through wisdom. The first five suppress it. And His Holiness the 42nd Sakyatrizin says about this, the antidotes to the cause of deficient moral discipline, the antidote to the cause of deficient moral discipline, which is the mental afflictions. So the mental afflictions can cause lots of problems and lead to many faults. To abandon these afflictions, we need to adopt two kinds of antidotes, suppressing the mental afflictions and eliminating them. For the suppression, in the case of desire, you need to think about your object of attachment, which commonly is a person, but could be an object. If we are attached to a person, we should contemplate the impurity of their body and so on. And seeing that the body is impure, we realize there's no point in being attached to it. Thinking in this way will enable us to suppress our attachment to a particular person. And so on. Every human body has flesh and bones and so on. And so if we think about the impurity of the body, we are doing a practice which is based on the sutra tradition, not the Vajrayana tradition. To suppress anger, we must practice loving kindness. We need to develop and practice loving kindness towards all beings without exception, including those we dislike or even hate. If we can extend our loving kindness to include even these individuals, anger will no longer arise in us, because anger and loving kindness cannot coexist. They are directly opposed. As an antidote to suppress ignorance, reflect on the law of karma and the interdependent nature of phenomena. These are the antidotes to suppress mental afflictions. The antidote that eliminates them is to meditate on the ultimate view of emptiness. By realizing selflessness, we can be free of mental afflictions because the root of them all is self-grasping, the belief in the existence of a self. If we investigate the object of this belief, the self, it cannot be found. At the moment, the term self is superimposed upon the collection of the five aggregates. The aggregates are just called the self. As it's said in the teachings, if we separate these five aggregates and try to locate the self in each of them individually, we can't find it. This means that the term self is merely imputed on the basis of the collection of aggregates. The body is not the self. When we say my cat or my house, it indicates that the house or the cat belongs to us, and that they are different from us. And similarly, when we say my body, which indicates that the body is not the self, but it belongs to the self. In short, when we analyze it with the wisdom, the self cannot be found, and in the absence of the self, there will be no self-grasping. This means that the direct realization of selflessness through wisdom can eliminate self-grasping, and in this way, also the mental afflictions. This is why transcendental wisdom is vital, and we should really devote time and effort to gain this realization. So that's the individual antidote to the cause of deficient moral discipline. Next time we'll talk about the moral discipline as the antidote to the result. So we've talked about the cause, and then we'll talk about the result. I think I'll stop there. Are there any questions about that part? I think we can say dedication now. So nam de tan jazi pani tob na nye pe danam pam jete ke ga na chi balung tu pe ye sit pe so le do Chub sem cho grim bo che ma ke pa nam ke gyu che ke ma nyam par me par yong gong ne gong tu pe par shu jam pa po ji tar ken Sang po de yang de jin te de da kung gi je su da lo che ge wa di da tam che ra du ngu tu sun shek pi gya wa tam che ki Dakshin ge we tsa wa di kun kyan Sang po cho chi rab dung o war gi Chak sa wa dang cho ching shak pa dang Jesu yi rang ku shing So I gave a chung zeta gichi saka tam jizu be chang chu chi. By this merit, may all attain omniscience, May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. By the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. In whatever way, Vagat Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit. So do I dedicate all of my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever virtue I may have gained by prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Michael.